LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Irvin Laszlo, who joins us to discuss his book, The Self-Actualizing Cosmos, The Akasha Revolution in Science and Human Consciousness. Science evolves through alternating phases of normal science and radical shifts that create scientific revolutions. We saw this at the turn of the 20th century when science shifted from a Newtonian worldview to Einstein's relativity paradigm, and again with the shift to the quantum paradigm. Now, as we recognize the non-local interconnection of all things in space and time, we find our scientific worldview shifting once again. The Self-Actualizing Cosmos explores the genesis of the current revolution in scientific thought and the latest findings in support of the Akashic field. It explains how the burgeoning Akasha paradigm returns our way of thinking to an integral consciousness, a non-linear mode of understanding that enables us to accept the reality of non-local interconnection throughout the world. This new inclusive way of understanding reaffirms the age-old instinctive comprehension of deep connections among people, societies, and nature, and it integrates and transcends classical religious and scientific paradigms. Hello and welcome, Irvin, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
And Greg, I'm very happy to be here. It's really good to talk with you.
Wonderful. Today, Irvin, we're going to talk about your recent book, The Self-Actualizing Cosmos. Subtitle is The Akasha Revolution in Science and Human Consciousness. Before we dive into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and your work.
Well, I don't know what I am, actually, because I don't fit into any preconceived box. I think the easiest way to say is that I'm a philosopher of science. I'm interested in philosophical questions, and I look to science to help me find answers. And basically, then I go wherever I like to go. I've been writing a number of books in the last 10 years on a topic which deals with a deeper dimension in the universe that is being discovered in quantum physics, which I call the Akasha dimension, because 5,000 years ago, the Hindu rishis talked about a deep dimension in the world that they call the Akasha. So that has been my interest, and my books in that area have received a certain level of at least readership, criticism as well, of course, but I'm continuing on that level. So I'm really interested in trying to explore the nature, the deep nature of the world, and how we can relate to that and what it can do for us.
For people who may not be familiar with it, can we say something just about the Akashic field, the nature of that, because that underpins a lot of this?
Well, everybody knows about the Akashic records, at least most people. I mean, it's sort of the claim that someplace, somewhere in nature, everything is recorded and that you can somehow get an access to that. Shirley MacLaine was talking about it, and a lot of ancient people have been talking about it. So that is the most widely known term. I have myself came across this term only after I have discovered that in science there is a consensus emerging and the leading edge of quantum cosmology and quantum field physics, that what we observe in the universe is a kind of a secondary reality. It's a manifestation, which is very much what the Hindus have been talking about, Brahman as the deep dimension and Lila is the play of the world that we perceive. So it's an ancient idea that is being rediscovered. And so I call it the Akasha. I could call it anything else, of course. Plato called it the realm, the sphere of the forms and ideas. Pythagoras called it the cosmos with a K. And so it has been known under many names. my interest lies in that because it can explain a lot. It can explain how things are connected to one another. Many of the things that we think are happening in the normal world around us, which is in space and time, actually happening on a deeper level beyond space and time, and they are manifesting in space and time. So that's the gist of it. And of course, then we can describe how this works out in science, what are the basis for it, what is the evidence for it, what does it mean for us. But the gist of it is really, to put it in the simplest possible terms, what we live as the everyday world is a manifestation, sometimes not this talked about a holographic projection, of a code or of a deeper dimension, of a deeper reality that is basically the real existence of the cosmos, a deeper or higher reality, as you like to call it. And that, to me, is a very interesting, very important fact or factor, because it explains a lot of things that we can't explain otherwise. And it also tells us that we need to search for the world, for the real world, not just directly take what we observe is immediately that world. It lies someplace deeper, as I think the ancients have known, scientists are beginning to rediscover. And that is, I think, the paramount fact that I want to call attention to, because through this revolution in science, through the new paradigm that's emerging, I think we're getting a very, very different image of the universe than, and of our world than they used to have.
Now, you used the word holographic, and it's been close to 25 years now since the popular book, The Holographic Universe, was published. And I recently reread that, and it was amazing, really, how many of the concepts and theories in there have, in the meantime, begun to be borne out by actual, hard, you know, repeatable, testable science.
Indeed, indeed. We can't explain how things will be related so closely to one another, because apparently these relationships seem to go way transcend, way beyond even the relativistic speed of light. I mean, because it's supposed to be the maximum speed with which signals can be sent in the universe. But things seem to be related much closer and much faster, much more immediately. The word that is being used in science now is entanglement. And its entanglement can be accepted as a fact. It's a very curious fact, but it can't be explained unless we take a kind of a holographic explanation. A hologram is a metaphor, of course. It can be something else, but what is, whatever it is an immediate givenness, a fact that things are given on that level, on that deeper dimension, at the same time, instantly. And then there is no space and no time. Because you don't travel in space, you don't take time in traveling from one to another. It's all given. We don't experience that with our senses. As I said, we experience the effects of it. But the basic explanation, the basic insight that we are getting, which I said, as I said, it's an age-old insight, is that it is there. The deep reality is what the ancients called the Akasha, or Plato called the world of forms. The Hindus called the Brahman. And this is the deepest reality. And it used to be an esoteric concept. Now it turns out to, as you say, it's rediscovered. It's becoming a scientific concept.
One popular objection to some of the new emerging ideas is that the behavior that we can observe at the quantum level doesn't apply at the macro level of you and I, trees, rocks, all the rest of it. But as a non-scientist, my simple thinking about it is, well, surely it must apply if the macro world is made up of these quantum objects.
Yeah, you're entirely right. Besides, there's a logical argument, of course, it's one of them. But it is also the observation that we can't explain many of the phenomena. For example, we can't even explain life in the human body. Information is spreading, is giving, being given almost simultaneously. It's there. There are quantum type of entanglements among the cells in our body. Otherwise, if all the cell information would proceed with the speed of neural transmission, 10 meters a second or so, we would not be alive. we would not have a complex organism where there are thousands and thousands of reactions happening every second in every cell. So the human body, every living body, is what we could call a macroscopic quantum system. And we can carry further. In fact, in this book and also in my previous book called Science and the Akashic Field, I'm giving anyway from 80 to 100 pages of examples of reasons how this kind of instant connection between things is absolutely necessary for us to understand how things are, how life is, how the cosmos is. Things are not mechanistic. They are not limited to speed of light, not limited to even to the relativistic level, much less so than the original mechanical physical transmission level. We are a highly informed, highly interconnected quantum type of universe, and that comes through on all levels. One of the arguments, as you say, is precisely that we are all based of quanta. But it's then that counter-argument is that on the level above quanta, there are these so-called Brownian motions. The things are happening, and this higher level of heat is occurring. And that cancels this kind of quantum connections, so that things, the particles, fall back into the classical mode of operation, which by classical mean a sort of Newtonian. They're only in one place at one time and moving within the limits prescribed by classical cosmology. So this cancellation apparently occurs in some places and some levels, but not in every level. There are very many places where quantum effects are necessary for things to occur the way they are occurring. Otherwise, they couldn't be simply there. The universe wouldn't be the way it is now unless it is thoroughly entangled in many, many levels.
You mentioned time, something of an abstract. I mean, time is a human concept, and no one really knows what time is. I mean, I've come to the conclusion basically that time doesn't exist. But it's interesting when we talk about the quantum realm, how much of it is actually observable versus theoretical. I'm thinking of the Higgs boson, for example. I mean, did we call that into summon that up into some form of reality because it was required to fit with observables? And I've talked to other quantum physicists about this, and they actually confess that, well, yeah, there's a degree to which a lot of these things that we're talking about at the quantum level, we can't pick them up, we can't turn them over, we can't measure them. But and for a lot of people, that's quite a surprise that we're talking about a lot of theoretical quote-unquote objects here.
Well, actually, practically all of the basic constants of the universe are not observable. You would think that a field is observable. Take a gravitational field. You drop an object and it falls to the ground, and you say, aha, we have just observed the gravitational field. No, you didn't. You observed the effect of that field. And this is not splitting hairs. I mean, it's basically the effect is universal. The field itself is universal, and the effect is local. So the gravitational field is there everywhere at all times. It has local effects, specific effects. The same is with the electromagnetic fields, with all the fields. Everything that we actually can observe is an effect of something that is in itself unobservable. You talk about some particles, for example. Lately, much talk has been about virtual particles. Now, these virtual particles are, very curious beasts. They pop in and out of existence. But it's a very easy and simple dismissal of the problem to say they stop existing for a while, then they come back again. But they come back the same way. So they didn't completely disappear. They didn't vanish. They're just not observable for a while. So talking about this deeper dimension, the Akasha, you can also explain what happens when a particle is not firmly established and is very fundamental, so-called very ultra-short-lived particles. They are not firmly established in space and time. They appear there, but then they disappear at tiny, tiny fractions of a second, and then they come back again. So there's a constant fluctuation between the space-time world and between a deeper world. And it seems that the fields the quantum fields and the other electromagnetic all kinds of fields, except probability fields, which are human constructions. All the other fields are basically elements of the world that exist on a level which in itself is not observable. Our sense organs have not been created. We are ourselves a kind of operating on a level where we do not interact directly with this deeper level. We might interact, but it's another argument if you want to get into that, on the level of pure consciousness, purely deep altered states possible. We can approach some of these deeper realities. But on the ordinary level, we do not simply have perceptive organs to interact, to register these deeper realities.
You mentioned fields, and we tend to think, those of us, you know, of a materialistic Newtonian perspective on reality, that matter is fundamental. But it seems increasingly, as research goes on, that fields are actually fundamental, or perhaps, as you just referred to a moment ago, perhaps a single field. And actually matter, I think, to use an expression from your book, it could be merely field excitation.
Well, that's the standard conception that's coming to the fore now in the leading edge of quantum and cosmology and field theory. Everything that we observe is an excitation of an underlying field. Now, if you don't excite that poor field, then you don't observe it. But what we observe is when there is something happening. It's like a deep sea, like a smooth sea, surface of the sea. We perceive waves. But if there is nothing waving, then we don't perceive that. It's just simply there. What we perceive is a local phenomenon, a manifestation of what is non-local. I want to emphasize this concept because we talk about entanglement, we talk about connection. It all actually comes down to this concept of non-locality. A thing that exists or happens at one place has an immediate, instant effect in other places, and maybe in all other places, if you could only measure it or get an idea of it. But it certainly is not limited. We are not limited to one point in space and one point in time.
Now, this idea of an unobservable background to reality is an ancient idea. Of course, we're talking about the Akashic field, which some people say zero-point field. This is reminiscent of Bohm's implicate order. And there's something in the book that you speak about which was new to me. Let's hope I'm pronouncing this correctly. Amplituhedron. Perhaps you could say something about that.
It's a concept. It's a theoretical device that has real effects. It's like, you know, I don't know if you know, but I mean, it was very popular to talk some years ago about the Feynman diagrams. There are certain diagrams. They have a certain shape, a geometrical shape. And if you follow that shape, then you can explain what happens when particles collide. They collide, and a lot of other particles are spewing force, and it seems that the space-time is broken open. Again, I mean, it can't be nothing. It must be something that is being broken open. So this underlying field is broken up when you have this extreme high-level energy injected by these super colliders. And the Feynman diagrams explain what happens. Only you have to have many, many diagrams and many calculations to come forth with the understanding, with the mapping of what kind of particles come forth and what kind of interactions. Now, the amplituhedron is a much more complex concept, but actually it's a very simple, basic geometrical form, which has as many dimensions as there are particles that it applies to. And it maps what happens when particles collide. So where is that amplituhedron? It's an object. It's like something like a Platonic object. You ask, you know, for example, you say, well, people love each other, but love is an object. Love exists. It exists someplace as a purely a concept, but love generates behavior in certain ways. So the amplituhedron also generates behavior. It explains how certain things happen. But this amplituhedron is not in space-time because it's not affected by anything that happens in space-time. The same way as the gravitational, any kind of field, is not affected by space-time. It affects space-time. Indeed, these fields are said, or this underlying field, is said to generate space-time itself. So originally in the world, there was this field that was the biblical notion of there being a basic kind of a substance in which the will of God and then creates the perturbations which are the actual things that happen in the world. So these fields are someplace, and unless you say that they are purely abstract conceptual, which is not much help, because then we don't explain how come that they produce a real effect. How can something that is not real produce a real effect? So all these produce real effects, and they are in a dimension that is in itself not observable. So that, I think, is the gist of the whole question.
Well, that begs the question then as to what real is, because again, it's similar. It's a human, part of human language, and what does that even mean? In the same way that when we observe the quantum world, we can ask what observation even means.
Well, sure. If you want to go down to that level, anything that we call real is a matter of belief. If you bang your nose against the window pane, then you say, okay, there must have been a glass there, even if I didn't see it originally. And so you say that glass is real. So real is, in some sense, that what you can experience through your senses. And that's the old positivistic notion that everything that we consider real must be experienced with our senses. But then 9/10 or 99% of modern scientific theory would have to be thrown out the window, because a lot of these things can't be observed directly with our senses. They have some effects that the effects of the effects of the effects, eventually there is something that is there. Like the entire relativity theory comes down to a couple of observations, like the advance of the perihelion of the planet Mercury, for example. And it says that we prove relativity theory. But the relativity equations, the relativity relationships, and space-time in which relativity occurs is not unobservable in itself. So real, I think, I'd be happy to accept as real as that as we can coherently and consistently name as having an effect in the world around us.
Well, of course, we ourselves have got, not only when we're talking about quantum realm, we have a limited ability to observe that. We obviously can't do with our five senses. We rely on scientific instruments. But, I mean, our human perception is tremendously limited. I mean, Aldous Huxley had the idea that all the information in the universe ever and the events should be available to our brains under certain circumstances instantaneously. But we are limited for a reason. So the idea that we could come to any conclusions about reality based on our eyes, our ears, our touch, taste, that we should expect to have a limited view of what is real.
Well, that would be, you have to distinguish what we can perceive as real and what we have a good reason to assume is real. Because the latter is not necessarily that what we can also perceive as real. So the universe of science is far larger, deeper, and more penetrating than the universe of actual experience. Experience is something that you infer into or to from what you set up. This raises a very fundamental question, of course, in the method of science. Do you infer your concept of the world from your experience, or do you deduce it and test it by your experience? I think the latter is the case. Since Einstein, it's one doesn't even question anymore that what comes first is kind of imagination, envisioning the world, seeing what it could possibly be, the world could be like. And then you are testing that hypothesis. Not everything will work out that you think the world is like. Something that just simply are not like that, or nothing. You can't observe anything of that sort. But if you have a good hypothesis, then it should have experiential, empirical consequences. And you set up a hypothesis as a free act of imagination, I'm still quoting Einstein, and then you test it against what you actually observe. So the entire method of science, I love this one basic saying for Einstein, although it's not very often quoted, I keep quoting it, which he says that the task of science is to seek the simplest possible scheme that can tie together the observed facts. So we seek the simplest possible scheme, we observe facts, and we try to connect them. It's like having a lot of dots in front of us. We prove this dot and that dot, and we see this, and there is something here, there is something there. Then we try to connect them in some way. We connect them in a limited way, okay, then that gets one local theory. But if there are other dots that we can't connect with that, then we ask, how come? What's the relationship between them? And ultimately, we are trying to connect all the dots. Because we can't do that with science, because contemporary science anyway, we have not improved that, advanced that much, and probably not with any human science ever will be able to. But the ideal is still to be able to connect all the dots, all the things that we presume could somehow exist. So the criterion of existence is not experiencing each thing. The criterion of existence, a reality, is coherence, consistency, hanging together, you know, having a meaningful gestalt in front of us. Call it idealistic, perhaps, but that's part of the human condition, as you yourself say.
Now, one question that has obsessed me since I was a child, and I just want to get your thoughts on this in light of your life and your work, is we're fascinated by, you know, the origin of what we observe, the universe of life. We think about the condition of the universe in a pre-Big Bang, if indeed there was a Big Bang status, and or post-Big Crunch. And the question always comes down to, you know, an origin, and it seems inescapable that can anything be infinite? If not, then when did the cycle begin? What was before that? And if it stops, what's behind what's stopping it? And this seems like an endless question. I've talked with so many of my guests about this. We don't seem to be any further forward with that. I just don't know what your reflections are on this big question in the light of all your work.
Ultimately, we get down to the question that we can't explain the origin, because the origin, we can explain some things that preceded any given thing, then something else preceded that. You know, it reminds me of the old story about the old lady who said that the world is supported by turtles. And then the question was, well, what supports the turtle? And she said, another turtle. And what supports that turtle? And the old lady lost patience and said, young man, it's turtles all the way. You know, so this is the only kind of explanation which you give, which is not a scientific explanation, that there is an infinite sequence. We can, if there was a beginning to that, we can't know it. But what we can see is that up to a given point, we can trace the events. For example, you mentioned Big Bang. I think something like the Big Bang has occurred. It's not necessarily a singularity, a single event in the universe. It's probably part of a sequence of events. Nowadays, some cosmologists talk about the Big Bounce. It's multiple universes sequentially occurring. One universe, when the other one collapsed, or perhaps even in the framework of previous universes coming about. And because many of the phenomena of the evolution of the microstructures of the universe seem to point to the fact that they had an origin, a quantum level origin. So, okay, so there was something preceding this universe, but then what preceded that universe? And that is where the turtles come in. You know, you can't explain that anymore. Then we have to perhaps go to theology as a possible answer. Maybe there's a cosmic will, a cosmic consciousness, which has created the universe and the sequence of cycles of the universe. But then you are beyond science, inevitably beyond science.
Now, a lot of people in their day-to-day lives, you know, non-scientists, would consider science to be a bit of an ivory tower pursuit that doesn't have much relevance for them beyond perhaps technological innovations. But I think that what has been revealed to us since the early 20th century and the quantum realm has begun to open up to us is actual very, very important lessons about the nature of who we are and about reality. That actually, of course, this is part of the theme of your book we're talking about, that are reflected in ancient ideas and can say something about how we should live, and that perhaps the competition paradigm should be replaced with a cooperation paradigm. But of course, that old paradigm, Newton, Darwin, materialism, competition, is still dominating us. And this is not an abstract question. And you spoke about this in your TED talk, for example. This has very profound implications for our future, if we're going to have one.
Yes, science ultimately is a guide to our conception of who we are and what the world is. I don't look at science as producing technology. Okay, technology is fine. It's another field, basically. And technology is piggybacking on science. But science is an effort to understand precisely what there is and to understand that there is something rather than nothing. And that if there is something, then how is it? You know? And that, for me, is science. So we are getting orientation, we are getting a basic concept from science to questions that people have always asked, ever since became conscious beings, God knows when, 20, 30, 50,000 years ago. We have asked, what is life? What is the world? What's behind the stars? You know, what is behind this? What precedes our birth? I mean, these are, do we have a destiny? How are we related to one another? These are perennial questions. And science, if you don't take it in the narrow concept, which is not just, of course, technology, but in the narrow disciplinary way, and we say that I am only dealing, meaning science, how quanta behave, or I am only mean by science how cells relate in an organ or in a tissue. I mean, unless you don't take this narrow view, but you ask yourself, science as a whole, what can it tell us? It can tell us something very, very different from the common sense assumption. And it can tell us something that is fundamental to our life. That's why I talk about paradigm in science, like Thomas Kuhn in the 70s that picked up this notion. A paradigm is not just a theory. It's a paradigm is a whole set of suppositions about the nature of what you're talking about, which is the world, which is life, which is human beings. And so a new paradigm gives us a very different concept of the world from the old paradigm. There were many paradigms, perhaps not infinite number, but maybe there are 10 or 12 kinds of paradigms are possible. Stephen Pepper, a great philosopher living 50 years ago, has written a book on the various paradigms that are possible in the world. And we are cycling through those. But the new paradigm, what I call the Akasha paradigm, is certainly very different from the classical Newtonian paradigm. And in this new paradigm, the interconnections are so close. The various things in the world constitute together, jointly make up a larger system, a larger reality, so that there is no sense in which you could compete to death between different parts of things that exist, because whatever you would be competing with, whatever you would be harming with through competition, you would be ultimately harming yourself, because we are part of that. So things are not individually separate, not separate or not separable. They ultimately hang together. And precisely in this deeper level, we are one. And recognizing that it has the real effect in the world, that when we harm others, that when we disadvantage others, we are introducing a malaise into the world that ultimately harms us, harms our chances for a happy and fulfilling life. I think we get a different system, different concept of who we are, what our world is, and how we should behave in this world. We should behave in a way in which is aligned with the fundamental nature of this world, which means interconnection, which means, to use this more esoteric but relevant term, which means oneness, holographic oneness or some kind of quantum oneness, but anyway, a oneness, a joining together, a communion of things rather than a separate kind of machine-like assembly of things.
Well, in closing, Irvin, I think that the interconnectedness of everything is becoming readily more apparent to us. And I also think it's obvious that this separateness from the rest of reality and creation that we as human beings suffer from now is a relatively recent thing in our broader history. And I think there was a time when science and spirituality, if I can use that word, were not completely separate, removed from each other. And of course, invoking the word spirituality these days can be a bit of a problem, because people conflate it utterly with religion. And we see the problems we have today. They're manifest. We only have to turn on the television of an evening to see what the problems are, have been created in the name of religion. But I think that moving forward, this realization of interconnectedness is dawning, and you use the expression, you know, we have a choice going forward, whether we shall be the first or the last. And my hope lies in, when I look at the world, I see what I call the dominators, people in control. We all know who we're talking about, corporations, governments. These people are different in a way from you and I. And I see young people now who are almost like a different species from those people I refer to as dominators, those people in control at the top who are, I think, holding us back.
You are absolutely right. And I'm very happy that you feel that and you see this, because that's the way to our salvation. I mean, we are facing a dead end, literally a dead end, if you move with this dominator paradigm, the mechanistic paradigm. We are increasingly fragmenting the world. We're increasingly sub-optimizing the system, as it were, you know, which we are creating more and more islands of concentrations of wealth and power, leaving out of the system more and more people on the margins and beyond the margins. That is not the solution. So the only way forward is this recognition dawning on us that we are living in a very different world than what we thought we were living in. And it doesn't mean that in the past there was a period when this worked, where this kind of dominator mentality worked. But things were much less tightly dependent on one another. There are many, much more degrees of freedom were there to be exploited. Think of, you know, America being colonized and with the notion of go west, young men, you know, there's almost a new horizons. And in many, many respects, the world was not such a tight place. We are now with 7 billion people and with this tremendous use of the natural resources and energy that we have. We are very close to the operating on the sustainability boundaries, edge of this human and natural system. So if we better recognize that we are dependent on one another, that we can do it together, but we can't do it separately. And if we are indeed together at one level, on the quantum level, or beyond the space-time level even, we are actually one, that recognition can help us to orient ourselves and to become actually one in our daily actions, because that is the only way that we can survive together.
Irvin, today we've been talking about your new book, The Self-Actualizing Cosmos. That's available everywhere. Is there anything you'd like to share with listeners in closing about, you know, perhaps you have a website or what you're working on going forward?
Well, my website has just my name, ervinlaszlo.com. But what I'm working on actually are two books. One of them is ready. It's now going into proofing stage and will be published in 3 months. And it's a follow-up to The Self-Actualizing Cosmos, but it's concentrating on consciousness. It has a very daring, bold title, again, evoking some an ancient insight. It's called The Immortal Mind, because I say that we are a psychophysical beings. We have a biological body, but we have a consciousness which is part of the holographic projection of a cosmic consciousness. Erwin Schrödinger said that, David Bohm talked about it, Gustav Jung talked about it. Again, not a new notion. Plato, of course, talked about it. What we call the soul or the spirit, or I prefer just to call the mind or consciousness, belongs to that deeper dimension, the Akasha dimension. I mentioned that in the current book, The Self-Actualizing Cosmos, but in the new book, I developed that with examples, many examples, of how consciousness persists beyond the brain and beyond this level of the space-time universe. So that's going to be published in October, and then I'm now starting research. Actually, I've got already some ways down, an even more daring, bold undertaking, talking about what is happening space and beyond space and time. So the title is actually Beyond Space-Time. But that will be another year and a half before it can come forth with it, if I manage to complete the research on it. But these are my interests, you know. I used to have a very great interest, which I still have, but it's not now the single focus of my interest, which is how to overcome the current predicament, the crisis. I used to be a member of the Club of Rome, then founded the Club of Budapest. We talk about the predicament of mankind. Then I talked about the world shift. But after 2012, I've started focusing on the fundamental concept of our world and how we can perceive ourselves as being part of this world. And therefore, the center of my attention is now consciousness. So in this self-actualizing cosmos, I talk about the new paradigm on many different aspects of it, including consciousness. And in the next year or two, I think I'll be concentrating heavily on the central concept of who are we, conscious entities who are both biological and somehow super biological.
Excellent. Well, Urban, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greg, thanks very much for this inside discussion. It's as always very illuminating. I'm very happy that you pick up these notions and deal with them. They're absolutely essential for understanding, but also for our future.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website. That's LegalizeFreedom.com, Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy, and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.